I was exploring this set of ideas, and I'm going to do that for a few more minutes, and then I'm going to turn to some real cases and finish with some cases viewed more or less this way. So, or partly this way. So the basic idea here is that different, qualitatively different parts of gene regulatory networks, when they change, they have different levels of effect in evolutionary functions. So one of the interesting, the other side of the kernel coin is the part that's flexible, what we call plugins. And so, as I mentioned, signaling systems are a great case, and Hox genes are really another case, and other things that work as switches. And I just wanted to consider this view of what Hox genes do for a minute. This is my view, don't blame anybody else. So. And there are lots of cases like this in the world. So this is a python embryo. The python actually has very small hind limb buds, which have been removed where that arrow is, because, as you know, the ancestor of snakes had four legs. And so much of our information is correlative, like here, for instance. And if you look at two particular Hox genes, which are middle Hox genes, which are expressed in a typical amniovertebrate, like a chicken, this way. So they're both expressed in a thoracic region only. Well, in the python, they're expressed throughout the whole body because the whole body actually has thoracic ribs on all the way down. And so you might look at that and say, well, so what? Does that mean that the Hox genes make the thorax? No, it means that the Hox genes don't make the thorax. A regulatory program that makes thoracic ribs is in operation, which we know a little something about, that begins with development of somites. And that program is different in different parts of our vertebral column, but that program is allowed to run throughout the whole body in a python, but only in the thoracic region in a chick. That's a kind of a observation, this is not an experiment, it's just an observation, that's most easily interpreted in terms of the idea that the role of the Hox gene is simply to permit or to prohibit a given developmental program that actually makes a piece of structure from operating. So one of the few cases where we really know what a Hox gene does in detail is the famous case of Ed Lewis's four-winged fly. The four-winged fly is my favorite weapon when talking to paleontologists who don't believe that genes have anything to do with evolution, and because it's a or haven't heard of genes. Loss of function mutation in the ultrabithorax gene, which is a Hox gene, which has the result of causing, so right away there's something you better start thinking about, the duplication of what happens in the second thoracic segment, which is the operation of the wing-making program. The same thing now happens in the third thoracic segment, instead of formation of a little tiny balance organ that's supposed to be there. So when a loss of function mutation causes something to happen, you realize that you're looking at a repression system. And so now we know enough about the gene network that makes the wing, this is Sean Carroll's work, to know that there are multiple places in which, in this gene network, in which the ones where it's shown to be direct at the cis-regulatory level are boxed in red, where the Hox protein acts as a specific repressor of expression of these genes by binding in its cis-regulatory, in their cis-regulatory elements. These are all regulatory genes, by the way. And all of them are upstream of aspects of wing patterning, as indicated in the diagram. And there are other UBX functions also. So what happens is that the normal Hox gene expression, which runs normally in T3 at the relevant time of life, shuts down the wing making system. And so when a loss of function mutation in that, the result is the wing making system is allowed to operate. And I show it to you because it's a perfect example. If you think about it, it's wrong to say UBX makes haltiers. It doesn't do that. It's a switch sitting on the outside of the wing patterning system, which is all this stuff downstream of these regulatory genes. And all it does is shut it off. So it's a switch. It's an input-output switch. And I think that a large number of Hox gene effects that have been noted in mouse gene knockouts of Hox genes and by natural mutations, wherever they've been seen, are often of exactly that type, so that some piece of patterning either happens in the wrong place or is not allowed to happen. And the reason is that sometimes the Hox switches are positive, sometimes they're negative. And you can see an extended account of that in my 2006 book, if you're curious. But say what? I don't. It may very well be that I don't know how widespread or conserved this set of functions is. Certainly, part of the one of the problems with that question is that these insects make their wings from imaginal discs, and that's a lot of the things that Diptera do are special to that branch of insect evolution. So I don't know to what extent these same functions are used for systems where the wings develop out of wing buds or something less like the imaginal disc. It may very well be that it's a general, but as usual, people work on what they're used to working on. So everybody works on flies, but we don't know much about wings and anything else. It would be very interesting to look at wings and dragonflies, which naturally had two wings that are the same fore and aft at this level. It may be. Anyway, so I want to leave you with those thoughts that different parts of gene networks evolve at very different rates. Changes of different kinds of subcircuits result in very different levels of change in evolution. So what I want to turn to now is, I don't know if we'll get to the last one, but at least two real evolutionary problems. Now, these are problems that haven't really been solved, but they're interesting to think about. One of them is stuff that, some evidence that we just got last week in our lab that might interest you. So the bilaterian eye is a famous problem because one of our prominent colleagues, Walter Gehring, has produced the idea that all the different kinds of bilateria, I think we should turn one of those lights out a bit. Can we do that? Just the one in front, particularly. That's the only one I turned out. Can't turn it. Okay. There you go. Speaking of eyes, so the bilaterian eyes are structured extremely differently. Some of them have a retina system, and others are just very many different kinds of eyes. The fly eye and the vertebrate eye are two of the most different in terms of their morphogenesis. So about almost the end of the 80s, almost 20 years ago now, it was discovered that a gene in mice, which was when mutant causes loss of the optic epithelium. So this is the lens placode, as it's called, in the cross section of the distal region of a mouse brain. This is the epithelium of the central nervous system, and here's this lens placode. That a mutation in a certain gene in mice causes just total loss of this thing. And you get blind mice in this mutation. The gene was PAX6, and amazingly, and it's expressed if you look in a cross section of a vertebrate nervous system, just in the place before the lens placode gets expressed. PAX6 turns on right that place. It assigns the progenitor field, as I would say, for the future lens placode. So, amazingly, it was discovered that PAX6 is the same gene that had been named Iwas in Drosophila, which, because mutants in Drosophila lack eyes. And so, this story was expanded. It turns out that there are actually two PAX6 genes in Drosophila, both required for eyes, and there are a number of other genes of different kinds. There's a little sub-circuit involving similar genes in both organisms. But but unfortunately, when you actually ask the question of how are those genes hooked up to each other, they're hooked up quite differently in the two organisms. Nonetheless, it was really striking that you could take the Drosophila eyeless gene, or any one of four or five other genes in this subcircuit, cause it to be expressed in a different imaginal disc and get eyes occurring on the leg or on the antenna or wherever. And so, Walter Gehring produced the argument that PAX6 or eyeless is a master gene for eye development, a master regulator, as he called it. And so the argument was then that even though these things are all different, somehow PAX6 is at the top of the morphogenetic program for all these different forms of development. Now, on the face of it, you might say, what is the morphogenetic program for these different forms of development? They're so different that there's nothing in common between them, although there are about five transcription factors that are used in these eyes, plus a number of others on both sides. So a severe problem, however, has arisen in very careful dissection of the vertebrate eye subnetwork, which I won't go into. But which shows that the linkages among the different genes in a subnetwork are all different. And so it is clear this is not a eye kernel which includes all these genes with PAX6 at the top. But there still remains the mystery of how you could find this amazing thing that if you cause ectopic expression PAX6 or several of these other genes, you can get eyes forming, even though with different circuits in both cases. And what is the evolutionary meaning of this? It's impossible to derive both these eyes from any kind of common ancestor that, as far as the structure of these eyes are concerned. So Walter himself at one point propose what I think is the right answer to this, although he seems to have gone away from that answer. But there's some other problems with the idea that the common ancestor of all bioterians had a morphogenetic program for eyes involving PAX6. And that is, if you look at the cis-regulatory module of PAX6, you'll find cis-regulatory system, you'll find different modules. This is the gene. You'll find different modules that cause expression in different pieces of the eye. That's okay, except that Drosophila doesn't have these pieces of the eye. And neither, in fact, do many other organisms, which have eyes, but they don't have a telencephalon, or they don't have a lens and cornea where PAX6 is running. And so here's a cis-regulatory apparatus for a gene that is proposed to have a pan-bilaterian morphogenetic function, which has cis-regulatory modules for pieces which are anything but pan-bilaterian. Well, some organisms don't have a cornea, for instance, in their eye. But so it means that this is a new piece of regulatory apparatus, new, or anyway, a vertebrate-specific piece, not that new. Possibly, it could be quite old because vertebrates are quite old. But it certainly is not pan-bilaterian. Yes. Because this piece of regulatory sequence listens to inputs that only exist in that piece of the vertebrate brain. So the answer to this mystery is probably of general importance. And that is that PAX6 does something else besides make eyes on antenna if you overexpress it. It runs downstream light photosensitive protein genes. And so if you look at lens crystallins or opsins, which are the light receptive proteins, these are lens crystallins, you look at their cis regulatory modules, the blue symbols are PAX6, strong and weak PAX6 binding sites for three different examples. And as has been shown in both vertebrates and flies, and the opsin genes also use PAX6 as regulators. PAX6 can be a master regulator for the morphogenesis of all these eyes. It's thinking about the problem exactly upside down. That the way to think about it is that the primitive situation was a differentiation gene battery, which may have been some light-sensitive photo eye spots exist even in single-cell organisms, where in more recent work, some of Walter's people have found that PAX6 is also used, and that, as it is in cnidarians, which have very different things than any of those eyes, so. And that the primitive evolutionarily initial use was to run a photosensitive eye gene battery. And that given that location, which puts a gene battery that makes photosensitive proteins in some place in the organism, that what happened after that was that those same regulatory proteins, some of these same proteins, in particular PAX6 and the others, since they're already being expressed in that place, became utilized in entirely different ways in the morphogenetic programs by which eyes develop in different branches of evolution. But that the original thing, what was there originally, was opsin gene batteries that were using PAX6 and other regulators. If that's the first, yeah. What? Well, you don't have to have an eyeball in order to have photoreceptors. It's not mislabeling. To make an eyeball, you can make photoreceptors in just a piece of flat epithelium. What's different among these eyes, they all use photoreceptors, but they all have different structures. We'll look at them without in detail. You can see this is different. But that's right. Well, in the heart case, we were, and in this gut case I mentioned, we're only talking about the initial stages in which a patch of cells is set aside and a certain regulatory state is imposed that is uniquely cardiac or endoderm or whatever. And in that case, and in this case I'm talking about this is the morphogenesis of the whole thing in this case. And so I'm asking, what's the issue here? what's the primitive role of PAX6? Is it to make I-morphogenesis, or is it to do something completely different, which is to run downstream batteries? Yeah.
This particular case, you already have to establish a location state, which is locked into the cell.
Right.
That, and then you started building under that.
Or on top of that. Whichever way you want to put it. But, yeah.
Well, it is the master switch, right? You get a whole lot. I mean, that is a fact.
But that's also true. That's also true, but it's no more true for PAX6 than for 5 other genes. That you overexpress, you get a whole lot. Dachshund and twin of Ilis and eyes absent and 6-3, they all do the same thing. And so there's nothing special about PAX6 in that respect.
But it's not very good on the battery the way down.
I'm saying evolutionarily, what's downstream today is upstream in evolution. That's what I'm saying. So that what's basically orthologous is the differentiation gene battery, not the morphology. Which you can just look at it, you know it's not orthologous. Well, because you're putting one gene which regulates another, first place, it only happens in imaginal disks, otherwise it doesn't happen. And so it already has a coordinate system, which is a dorsal, ventral, and anterior posterior coordinate system. It has certain signaling systems, which these genes control, these regulatory genes control. And when that goes on, the other ones in this little subnetwork goes on. What? It could be, except that here the experiment is done of ectopically expressing it and getting the ectopic thing happening. The only thing that's been done like that is when that set of genes was expressed in the heart, one of them doesn't do it in that case. Maybe that's a minor difference. But the point I want to make is this proposition of intercalation, so to speak, of programs for body part formation using the same regulators that were early in evolution. This is supposed to be about evolutionary processing. Early in evolution used to run differentiation gene batteries. So, yes? Yeah, it's used all over the place. It's used in us. It's used, as you can see from this picture, is using the pancreas. It's necessary for pancreatic beta cell differentiation, where it's involved in the gene network. It's involved in a lot of brain development, and it's expressed in nervous systems all over the place. So there's nothing specific about it. No, it's the downstream. So in any gene regulatory network, the differentiation gene batteries are at the periphery of the network. There's no feedback from them into the middle. It's the end of the street. That's the end of the road. So what happens in development is there's some transient regulatory state. There's some specification functions which say you're going to be this, and set it setting up a regulatory state of a particular kind for that body part. There's activation of the regulators that run the differentiation gene batteries, and it ends up with expression of those. That's the end of the street. So the gene batteries are mounted on the morphology for the gene battery product. Yeah. Four or five, yeah. No. That, if you what? Yeah, most of them, if you knock them out, you get no eyes or severely deficient eyes. No, you don't. You get something, but it's still pretty amazing. You get omnotidia. That's right. That's perfectly true. But you get something that's certainly not an antenna. What? I didn't hear. Yeah. No. Okay, so anyway, this is the idea that may be more general, that in considering the very early origins of morphogenetic structures in pre-Cambrian levels of discussions, we might consider first the useful function, no matter how simple your morphology, mediated by differentiation gene batteries, putting in place the regulators and building the morphogenetic program out of them. Okay, I want to now go to another case that I think is a good example of how things actually change in evolution. And I want to return to my favorite model, the sea urchin. And again, this is a comparison between sea urchins and sea stars. And this is the last thing I'm going to tell you about. And as I mentioned the other day, the sea urchins have this apparatus for building skeleton in the embryo. This is the gene regulatory network for the whole endomesoderm. We're looking at this part now. Here's the kernel we were talking about over here. And these genes down here in this box are biomineralization genes and genes that are particular differentiation genes for the cells that make the skeleton. And so this part of the apparatus is what triggers, is what specifies the lineage of cells to be skeletogenic. And remember, as I told you, it's that double repression system where this gene goes on, it turns off this gene. This gene is a globally active repressor. It's only de-repressed in these cells, and the immediate targets, as indicated by these brown lines, are this regulator, and this regulator, as well as a couple of other genes that involve signaling to adjacent cells. Okay? And right downstream of this, by the way, is a typical, what I would say, expected architectural feature, which is a feedback system, which is set up that once it sets going, it locks the system in, and it feeds back onto this gene, one of the main skeletogenic regulators. So this is just a typical piece of regulatory apparatus, except for this rather peculiar double negative start of it. So again, what it does is repress a repressor only in these cells, so that only in these cells the skeletogenic function is expressed. And as I showed you, if this repressor is expressed all over the egg, all these genes go on all over the egg, and the whole embryo turns into skeletogenic cells. Starfish don't have this. They don't make any embryonic skeleton at all. So, in fact, if you consider the phylogeny, it's rather strange. The sister group of the sea urchins or the sea cucumbers, they don't make a larval skeleton either. And the sister group of the ophiuroids do, but they do it completely differently. And the crinoids, the outgroup, the basal outgroup of all these other animals, don't make a larval skeleton either. So it's clear from the phylogenetic topology that the primitive situation was no embryo or larval skeleton. We do know, though, that only the modern sea urchins do all this, which are the sea urchins that have used ordinary ones you see with thin spines. And there's some more primitive urchins around still called pencil urchins. You often see in Mexico girls with these thick spine necklaces. Those are from cideroid sea urchins. The cideroids were the only sea urchins before the Permian-Triassic extinction, which is 250 million years ago. And they don't do this stuff. They don't have a precocious micromere lineage that make skeleton. So this is something that happened in evolution since the Permian-Triassic extinction, in the line of evolution just leading to the modern sea urchins. So that's pretty interesting. Where did all this apparatus come from when it's of that recent origin? Interesting question. And that's a pretty complete picture of the apparatus, by the way. There's probably no other genes to be, regulatory genes that go into that. The genes are in all the genomes because the genes are always used. But where did this set, yeah, this set of network connections, which is portrayed here?
Right.
You probably could if you could, if you would have done that, but we don't have the sequences of these other things, so, and we don't have the genes, and you could do that, but I think there's a simpler way to look at it. So, where did it come from? So one way of looking at it is that all these guys, by phyletic definition, make a skeleton, but they make it in their adult body plan. So one idea is that they, that the whole skeletonic apparatus was stolen from the adult body plan, adult skeletogenesis, and imported into the micromeres. And so then the question, if you want to examine that theory, the question is, what would be the minimum path length in terms of regulatory changes to get that to happen? So we, now you can study adult skeletogenesis by looking in the advanced larva where the spines of the baby sea urchin start to be made. And so the first thing we did was ask, are they using the same proteins as in the embryonic one? So here are two of these particular proteins. And I'll just show you some, this is work a postdoc called Fengao did recently. So here are the baby spines of a baby adult sea urchin. These are its five primary tube feet here. And it is definitely using this one protein. And here's another one it's also expressing. So the downstream proteins are at least some of them the same as in the adult skeleton. What about the regulators? So these are now plates of the body wall, not spines. And you see these beautiful pictures that you can see that are expressing this guy. Well, this is the same guy as here that's being used as a regulator of skeletogenesis that drives a lot of downstream genes in the embryo. And they're expressing this guy. This is another one of these guys that's very important right here. These are direct targets of this double repression system. But they're not expressing this guy. That's T-brain, by the way. And they're also not expressing that PMAR1 either. And so when you finish tallying up what's expressed and what isn't expressed, here's the way it looks. So the blue part is micromere specific. It's not in the adult skeletogenesis system at all. The whole pink part, which is the is in the adult skeletogenesis system. So you can see by looking at this that this whole piece of apparatus was stolen, so to speak, and put into the micromeres in relatively recent evolutionary time. That's kind of interesting. This mess here is mainly concerned with signaling functions of the micromeres that are not in the adult skeletogenesis system, needless to say. So, if you want to think about what's the simplest, so how many steps does it take to to do this? Now, this is a real change. One of these embryos has this fancy skeleton, it doesn't have any. How many steps does it take? So, the initial state is the adult, is only to have an adult skeleton. The echinoid embryo skeleton appeared relatively recently. The echinoid micrometers already have that PMAR-1 system because they use it to control signaling through delta, which is this notch ligand that I told you about last week that controls specification of the neighboring cells, which become mesoderm. That's also under PMAR-1 control. So they have that already. So the minimum path to steal the adult skeletogenic pathway would be to put the sites for this repressor into the cis regulatory modules that control those genes, basically. And then to put this repressor under PMAR-1 control, so it's only not present in the micromeres. So it's also possible that HESC is used in the adult skeletogenic system, in which case the only thing that might have been necessary would be to put HESC under PMAR-1 control. So, and we'll find that, we'll find those things out. But that's an example of a kind of change that you can rationalize when you start looking at this at the gene network level. You can start thinking about what really happened in evolution. Instead of just saying, oh, it has a skeleton. And I think that, as in other areas, the minimum path length is a useful argument for something like this, but it also explains this peculiar looking jury rigging that you see in this. As I mentioned when I was talking about it to you the other day, who would have guessed that the reason micromeres make skeleton is because they express a repressor? That's definitely not what you would have thought of. And it's just an instructive case. In looking at the gene networks of today, we're looking at a mosaic of old and new things, things that are loaded in on top of other things by evolutionary processes, and that the overall architecture, it is the product of a mosaic kind of evolutionary process. And we're never going to understand gene regulatory networks unless we know something about that. You can't look at the assembly of what's the neatest way of engineering this thing. So I think I'll end with that little seminar. Yeah, that's right. The whole thing was hijacked. So now what you have to do is just get the control system to run it in the right place. The control system's already there running other things. So I think it's a neat solution to this problem. Because evolution is change, and there are very few cases where you can actually look at the change and at least think about the mechanics of what actually happened at the DNA level, which is putting target sites for the right factor. Well, yeah. Well, the spatial pattern that happens later is due to this guy here. Let me go back to the main network and see it better. And this is a receptor of a ligand that's expressed in the ectoderm. This is much later now. And so the cells make skeleton where they get that, where they receive that signal. Yeah, you saw it. One of my pictures. They sure do. Those are skeleton-making cells. You can see the skeletal rod sort of dimly there. You can see it. Here you can see it a little more clearly. That's an embryo skeleton. That's made by the descendants. These cells... It appears in the right place because of subsequent things that had to be added too, of course, which is the patterning device in the ectoderm. And different species do that differently, but all echinoids make some kind of embryo skeleton. I'm just talking about giving it a cell lineage that makes, that runs these genes and makes the skeleton. Yeah.
It looks like some logic I used
to be here.
Somewhat? If I thought the area used to hijack a piece of network from
Well, here, there's nothing, the reason we did this experiment was because looking at the network, exactly as you say, it appeared that if you could, it appeared that if ALX1 and ETS particularly, because they're the ones that run most of these downstream genes, T-brain has a minor but important role, that if we could find out how those, if those things are expressed in the adult skeleton, then it would mean that all the rest of it comes along as a package under their control, more or less, particularly given this feedback system, which locks the whole system in once they start going. And so that's why we looked in the adult, and we were surprised to find them there, although in retrospect, of course, it makes perfect sense, because now all you have to figure out is how do you get those guys going in this place? And as I said, the microarrays already have this piece of the apparatus because they use it to run this signaling system. Probably they did that even before they made skeleton in evolution.
I mean, generally speaking, the network has to protect itself by changing some redundant regions to make sure that the particular subnetwork is not expressed what it's subunit.
True.
It's harder to hijack, right?
I would say that those repressions, so you're perfectly right that there are numerous functions that exclude alternative functions, but they are alternative functions that might possibly be called into play if something got mixed up at the same time, like it's something a next door cell would do. They're not protections against something that only happens in the adult. Where what? Oh, in this case, I would predict that this five gene system will be found throughout all echinoderms in the skeletogenic system. I don't know if that's true. I have no idea, but that's my prediction. With the same wiring. And that's a phyletic, that's a distinctive phylum, definitive phyletic apparatus of a kind of, because only they make this calcite skeleton. It's based on calcium, magnesium carbonate instead of calcium phosphate like our bone, Yeah. They're the only deuterostomes that make this kind of skeleton. I think I've exhausted you all thinking about impossible subjects. So you know, evolution is a difficult problem and we don't have the answers. I can tell you about gene networks, this is how it works. But I can't do that with evolution. I know, but that's because they can't think about them in terms of just actually what target sites have to be put in a cis regulatory module. So, if you want to say, here's a big change that happened, then I can show you how it could have been, if HES-C is used in the adult, which may be, in which case the pink would include that, which I will soon know, then the only thing that really had to happen to hijack this thing was to put HES-C under PMAR1 control. That's a PAX gene. I need to put packs target sites into the HESC gene regulatory element. Well, you know, speculations like this have an additional value, which is you can test them. So it should be possible to take the starfish adult skeletogenic system and make it run in the embryo by doing this, if that's true. So this is where, I guess there is one thing I wanted to say, is that people don't, like our funding agencies, think that evolution is not really useful to think about, and so it's hard to get any of this kind of thing funded. But it becomes convergent with something they do think is very interesting, which is re-engineering development. So when you get down to this level, this is a natural laboratory for re-engineering developmental regulatory circuits. And so I think it's going to all come full circle and end up with making synthetic networks that will explain evolution and explain development. Yeah, sorry.